Side 6, 2010, Odyssey 2, continuing on page 249. Chapter 48, Over the Night Side. To Heywood Floyd, aboard the suddenly unfamiliar, because no longer weightless, environment of Leonov's flight deck, the sequence of events had seemed more like a classic slow-motion nightmare than reality. Only once before in his life had he known a similar situation, when he had been in the back of a car during an uncontrollable skid. There had been that same sense of utter helplessness, coupled with the thought, "This doesn't really matter. It's not actually happening to me." Now that the firing sequence had started, his mood changed. Everything seemed real again. It was working out exactly as they had planned. Hal was guiding them safely back to Earth. With every minute that passed, their future was becoming more secure. Floyd began slowly to relax, even though he remained alert to all that was happening around him. For the very last time, and when would any man come here again, he was flying over the night side of the greatest of planets, encompassing the volume of 1,000 Earths. The ships had been rolled so that Leonov was between Discovery and Jupiter, and their view of the mysteriously glimmering cloudscape was not blocked. Even now, dozens of instruments were busily probing and recording. Hal would continue the work when they were gone. Since the immediate crisis was over, Floyd moved cautiously down from the flight deck. How strange to feel weight again, even if it was only 10 kilos, and joined Xenia and Katerina in the observation lounge. Apart from the very faintest of red emergency lights, it had been completely blacked out so that they could admire the view with unimpaired night vision. He felt sorry for Max Brailovsky and Sasha Kovalev, who were sitting in the airlock, fully suited up, missing the marvelous spectacle. They had to be ready to leave at a moment's notice to cut the straps securing the ships together if any of the explosive charges failed to operate. Jupiter filled the entire sky. It was a mere 500 kilometers away, so they could see only a tiny fraction of its surface, no more than one could see of Earth from an altitude of 50 kilometers. As his eyes grew accustomed to the dim light, most of it reflected from the icy crust of distant Europa, Floyd could make out a surprising amount of detail. There was no color at this low level of illumination, except for a hint of red here and there. But the banded structure of the clouds was very distinct, and he could see the edge of a small cyclonic storm looking like an oval island covered with snow. The great black spot had long since fallen astern, and they would not see it again until they were well on the way home. Down there beneath the clouds, occasional explosions of light flared, many of them obviously caused by the Jovian equivalent of thunderstorms. But other glows and outbursts of luminescence were more long-lived, and of more uncertain origin. Sometimes rings of light would spread out like shock waves from a central source, and occasional rotating beams and fans occurred. It required little imagination to pretend that they were proof of a technological civilization down beneath those clouds, the lights of cities, the beacons of airports. But radar and balloon probes had long ago proved that nothing solid was down there for thousands upon thousands of kilometers, all the way to the unattainable core of the planet. Midnight on Jupiter. This last close-up glimpse was a magical interlude he would remember all his life. He could enjoy it all the more because surely nothing could now go wrong, and even if it did, he would have no reason to reproach himself. He had done everything possible to ensure success. It was very quiet in the lounge. No one wished to speak as the carpet of clouds unrolled swiftly beneath them. Every few minutes, Tanya or Vasily announced the status of the burn. Toward the end of Discovery's firing time, tension began to increase again. This was the critical moment, and no one knew exactly when it would be. There was some doubt as to the accuracy of the fuel gauges, and the burn would continue until they were completely dry. "Estimated cutoff in 10 seconds," said Tanya. "Walter, Chandra, get ready to come back. Max, Vasily, stand by in case you're needed. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1... 0." There was no change. The faint scream of Discovery's engines still reached them through the thickness of the two hulls, and the thrust-induced weight still continued to grip their limbs. "We're in luck," thought Floyd. "The gauges must have been reading low, after all. Every second of extra firing was a bonus. It might even mean the difference between life and death, and how strange to hear a count up instead of a count down. 5 seconds. 10 seconds. 13 seconds. That's it. Lucky 13. Weightlessness and silence returned. On both ships there was a brief burst of cheering. It was quickly truncated, for much was still to be done, and it had to be done swiftly. Floyd was tempted to go to the airlock so that he could give his congratulations to Chandra and Curnow as soon as they came aboard. But he would only be in the way. The airlock would be a very busy place as Max and Sasha prepared for their possible EVA, and the tubeway joining the two ships was disconnected. He would wait in the lounge to greet the returning heroes. And he could now relax even further, perhaps from 8 to 7 on a scale of 10. For the first time in weeks, he could forget about the radio cutoff. It would never be needed. Hal had performed impeccably. Even if he wished, he could do nothing to affect the mission, since Discovery's last drop of propellant had been exhausted. "All aboard," announced Sasha. "Hatches sealed. I'm going to fire the charges." There was not the faintest sound as the explosives were detonated, which surprised Floyd. He had expected some noise to be transmitted through the straps, taut to steel bands that linked the ships together. But there was no doubt that they had gone off as planned, for Leonov gave a series of tiny shudders, as if someone was tapping on the hull. A minute later, Vasily triggered the attitude jets for a single brief burst. "We're free," he shouted. "Sasha, Max, you won't be needed. Everyone get to your hammocks. Ignition in 100 seconds. And now Jupiter was rolling away, and a strange new shape appeared outside the window. The long skeletal frame of Discovery, navigation lights still shining as it drifted away from them and into history. No one remained for sentimental farewells. In less than a minute, Leonov's drive would start to operate. Floyd had never heard it under full power and wanted to protect his ears from the roaring scream that now filled the universe. Leonov's designers had not wasted payload on sound insulation that would be needed for only a few hours of a voyage that would last for years. And his weight seemed enormous, yet it was barely a quarter of that which he had known all his life. Within minutes, Discovery had vanished astern, though the flash of its warning beacon could be seen until it had dropped below the horizon. Once again, Floyd told himself, "I'm rounding Jupiter, this time gaining speed, not losing it." He glanced across at Xenia, just visible in the darkness with her nose pressed to the observation window. Was she also recalling that last occasion, when they shared the hammock together? There was no danger of incineration now. At least she would not be terrified of that particular fate. Anyway, she seemed a much more confident and cheerful person, undoubtedly thanks to Max, and perhaps Walter as well. She must have become aware of his scrutiny, for she turned and smiled, then gestured toward the unwinding cloudscape below. "Look," she shouted in his ear, "Jupiter has a new moon!" "What is she trying to say?" Floyd asked himself. Her English still isn't very good, but she couldn't possibly have made a mistake in a simple sentence like that. I'm sure I heard her correctly, yet she's pointing downward, not upward. And then he realized that the scene immediately below them had become much brighter. He could even see yellows and greens that had been quite invisible before. Something far more brilliant than Europa was shining on the Jovian clouds. Leonov itself, many times brighter than Jupiter's noonday sun, had brought a false dawn to the world it was leaving forever. 100-kilometer-long plume of incandescent plasma was trailing behind the ship as the exhaust from the Sakharov drive dissipated its remaining energies in the vacuum of space. Vasily was making an announcement, but the words were completely unintelligible. Floyd glanced at his watch. Yes, that would be right about now. They had achieved Jupiter escape velocity. The giant could never recapture them. And then, thousands of kilometers ahead, a great bow of brilliant light appeared in the sky, the first glimpse of the real Jovian dawn, as full of promise as any rainbow on Earth. Seconds later, the sun leaped up to greet them, the glorious sun that would now grow brighter and closer every day. A few more minutes of steady acceleration, and Leonov would be launched irrevocably on the long voyage home. Floyd felt an overwhelming sense of relief and relaxation. The immutable laws of celestial mechanics would guide him through the inner solar system, past the tangled orbits of the asteroids, past Mars. Nothing could stop him from reaching Earth. In the euphoria of the moment, he had forgotten all about the mysterious black stain expanding across the face of Jupiter. Chapter 49, Devourer of Worlds. They saw it again the next morning, ship's time as it came around to the dayside of Jupiter. The area of darkness had now spread until it covered an appreciable fraction of the planet, and at last they were able to study it at leisure and in detail. "Do you know what it reminds me of?" said Katerina. "A virus attacking a cell. The way a phage injects its DNA into a bacterium and then multiplies until it takes over."
"Are you suggesting," asked Tanya incredulously, "that Zagadka is eating Jupiter?"
"It certainly looks like it."
"No wonder Jupiter is beginning to look sick.
But hydrogen and helium won't make a very nourishing diet, and there's not much else in that atmosphere. Only a few percent of other elements,
which adds up to some quintillions of tons of sulfur and carbon and phosphorus and everything else at the lower end of the periodic table," Sasha pointed out. "In any case, we're talking about a technology that can probably do anything that doesn't defy the laws of physics. If you have hydrogen, what more do you need? With the right know-how, you can synthesize all the other elements from it."
"They're sweeping up Jupiter, that's for sure," said Vasily. "Look at this."
An extreme close-up of one of the myriad identical rectangles was now displayed on the telescope monitor. Even to the naked eye, it was obvious that streams of gas were flowing into the two smaller faces. The patterns of turbulence looked very much like the lines of force revealed by iron filings clustered around the ends of a bar magnet.
"A million vacuum cleaners," said Kernow, "sucking up Jupiter's atmosphere."
"But why? And what are they doing with it?"
"And how do they reproduce?" asked Max. "Have you caught any of them in the act?"
"Yes and no," answered Vasily. "We're too far away to see details, but it's a kind of fission, like an amoeba."
"You mean they split in two, and the halves grow back to the original size?"
"Niet. There aren't any little Zagadkas. They seem to grow until they've doubled in thickness, then split down the middle to produce identical twins, exactly the same size as the original. And the cycle repeats itself in approximately 2 hours.
2 hours, exclaimed Floyd. No wonder that they're spread over half the planet. It's a textbook case of exponential growth.
I know what they are, said Ternovsky in sudden excitement. They're von Neumann machines.
I believe you're right, said Vasily, but that still doesn't explain what they're doing. Giving them a label isn't all that much help.
And what, asked Katerina plaintively, is a von Neumann machine? Explain, please.
Orlov and Floyd started speaking simultaneously. They stopped in some confusion, then Vasily laughed and waved to the American.
Suppose you had a very big engineering job to do, Katerina. And I mean big, like strip mining the entire face of the moon. You could build millions of machines to do it, but that might take centuries. If you were clever enough, you'd make just one machine, but with the ability to reproduce itself from the raw materials around it. So you'd start a chain reaction, and in a very short time you'd have bred enough machines to do the job in decades instead of millennia. With a sufficiently high rate of reproduction, you could do virtually anything in as short a period of time as you wished. The space agency's been toying with the idea for years, and I know you have as well, Tanya.
Yes, exponentiating machines. One idea that even Tsiolkovsky didn't think of.
I wouldn't care to bet on that, said Vasily. So it looks, Katerina, as if your analogy was pretty close.
A bacteriophage is a von Neumann machine.
Aren't we all? Asked Sasha. I'm sure Chandra would say so.
Chandra nodded his agreement.
That's obvious. In fact, von Neumann got the original idea from studying living systems.
And these living machines are eating Jupiter.
It certainly looks like it, said Vasily. I've been doing some calculations, and I can't quite believe the answers, even though it's simple arithmetic.
It may be simple to you, said Katerina. Try to let us have it without tensors and differential equations.
No, I mean simple, insisted Vasily. In fact, it's a perfect example of the old population explosion you doctors were always screaming about in the last century. Zagadka reproduces every 2 hours. So in only 20 hours there will be 10 doublings. One Zagadka will have become 1,000.
1,024, said Chandra.
I know, but let's keep it simple. After 40 hours there will be 1,000,000. After 80, 1,000,000,000. That's about where we are now, and obviously the increase can't continue indefinitely. In a couple more days at this rate, they'll weigh more than Jupiter.
So they'll soon begin to starve, said Zanya.
And what will happen then?
Saturn had better look out, answered Berlovsky.
Then Uranus and Neptune.
Let's hope they don't notice little Earth.
What a hope. Zagadka's been spying on us for 3 million years.
Walter Kernow suddenly started to laugh.
What's so funny?
Demanded Tanya.
We're talking about these things as if they're persons, intelligent entities. They're not. They're tools. But general-purpose tools, able to do anything they have to.
The one on the moon was a signaling device, or a spy, if you like. The one that Bowman met, our original Zagadka, was some kind of transportation system. Now it's doing something else, though God knows what. And there may be others all over the universe.
I had just such a gadget when I was a kid. Do you know what Zagadka really is? Just the cosmic equivalent to the good old Swiss Army knife.
Part 7, Lucifer Rising. Chapter 50, Farewell to Jupiter. It was not easy to compose this message, especially after the one he had just sent to his lawyer. Floyd felt like a hypocrite, but he knew it had to be done to minimize the pain that was inevitable on both sides. He was sad, but no longer disconsolate, because he was coming back to Earth in an aura of successful achievement. Even if not precisely heroism, he would be bargaining from a position of strength. No one would be able to take Chris away from him.
My dear Caroline, it was no longer my dearest, I am on my way home. By the time you get this, I'll already be in hibernation. Only a few hours from now, as it will seem to me, I'll open my eyes and there will be the beautiful blue Earth hanging in space beside me. Yes, I know it will still be many months for you, and I'm sorry, but we knew that's the way it would be before I left. As it is, I'm getting back weeks ahead of schedule because of the change in the mission plan. I hope we can work something out. The main question is, what's best for Chris? Whatever our own feelings, we must put him first. I know I'm willing to do so, and I'm sure you are.
Floyd switched off the recorder. Should he say what he had intended? A boy needs his father? No, it would not be tactful and might only make matters worse. Caroline might well retort that between birth and 4 years old, it was the mother who mattered most to a child, and if he had believed otherwise, he should have stayed on Earth.
Now, about the house. I'm glad the Regents have taken that attitude, which will make it much easier for both of us. I know we both love the place, but it will be too big now and will bring back too many memories. For the time being, I'll probably get an apartment in Hilo. I hope I can find some permanent place as quickly as possible. That's one thing I can promise everyone. I won't leave Earth again. I've had enough of space traveling for one lifetime. Oh, perhaps the moon, if I really have to. But, of course, that's just a weekend excursion.
And talking of moons, we've just passed the orbit of Sinope, so we're now leaving the Jovian system. Jupiter is more than 20 million kilometers away and is barely larger than our own moon. Yet even from this distance you can tell that something terrible has happened to the planet. Its beautiful orange color has vanished. It's a kind of sickly gray, only a fraction of its former brilliance. No wonder it's only a faint star now in the sky of Earth. But nothing else has happened, and we're well past the deadline. Could the whole thing have been a false alarm or a kind of cosmic practical joke? I doubt if we'll ever know. Anyway, it's brought us home ahead of schedule, and I'm grateful for that. Goodbye for the present, Caroline, and thank you for everything. I hope we can still be friends, and my dearest love, as ever, to Chris.
When he had finished, Floyd sat quietly for a while in the tiny cubicle he would not need much longer. He was just about to carry the audio chip up to the bridge for transmission when Chandra came drifting in. Floyd had been agreeably surprised by the way in which the scientist had accepted his increasing separation from Hal. They were still in touch for several hours every day, exchanging data on Jupiter and monitoring conditions aboard Discovery. Though no one had expected any great display of emotion, Chandra seemed to be taking his loss with remarkable fortitude. Nikolai Ternovsky, his only confidant, had been able to give Floyd a plausible explanation for his behavior.
Chandra's got a new interest, Woody. Remember, he's in a business where if something works, it's obsolete. He's learned a lot in the last few months. Can't you guess what he's doing now? Frankly, no. You tell me.
He's busy designing HAL 10,000.
Floyd's jaw dropped. So that explains those long messages to Urbana that Sasha's been grumbling about. Well, he won't be blocking the circuits much longer.
Floyd recalled that conversation when Chandra entered. He knew better than to ask the scientist if it was true, for it was really none of his business. Yet there was another matter about which he was still curious.
Chandra, he said, I don't believe I ever thanked you properly for the job you did at the flyby when you persuaded HAL to cooperate. For a while, I was really afraid he'd give us trouble. But you were confident all along, and you were right.
Still, didn't you have any qualms?
Not at all, Dr. Floyd.
Why not? He must have felt threatened by the situation, and you know what happened last time.
There was a big difference. If I may say so, perhaps the successful outcome this time had something to do with our national characteristics.
I don't understand.
Put it this way, Dr. Floyd. Bowman tried to use force against HAL. I didn't. In my language, we have a word. Ahimsa. It's usually translated as non-violence, though it has more positive implications. I was careful to use ahimsa in my dealings with HAL.
Very commendable, I'm sure. But there are times when something more energetic is needed, regrettable though the necessity may be.
Floyd paused, wrestling with temptation. Chandra's holier-than-thou attitude was a little tiresome. It wouldn't do any harm now to tell him some of the facts of life.
I'm glad it's worked out this way. But it might not have done so, and I had to prepare for every eventuality.
Ahimsa, or whatever you call it, is all very well. I don't mind admitting I had a backup to your philosophy. If HAL had been, well, stubborn, I could have dealt with him.
Floyd had once seen Chandra crying. Now he saw him laughing, and that was an equally disconcerting phenomenon.
Really, Dr. Floyd, I'm sorry you give me such low marks for intelligence. It was obvious from the beginning that you'd install a power cutout somewhere. I disconnected it months ago.
Whether the flabbergasted Floyd could think of a suitable answer would never be known. He was still giving a very creditable imitation of a gaffed fish when up on the flight deck Sasha cried out,
Captain, all hands, get to the monitors. Bozhmoy, look at that.
Chapter 51, The Great Game. Now the long wait was ending. On yet another world, intelligence had been born and was escaping from its planetary cradle. An ancient experiment was about to reach its climax. Those who had begun that experiment so long ago had not been men, or even remotely human. But they were flesh and blood, and when they looked out across the deeps of space, they had felt awe and wonder and loneliness. As soon as they possessed the power, they set forth for the stars. In their explorations, they encountered life in many forms and watched the workings of evolution on a thousand worlds. They saw how often the first faint sparks of intelligence flickered and died in the cosmic night. And because in all the galaxy they had found nothing more precious than mind, they encouraged its dawning everywhere. They became farmers in the fields of stars. They sowed, and sometimes they reaped. And sometimes, dispassionately, they had to weed. The great dinosaurs had long since perished when the survey ship entered the solar system after a voyage that had already lasted 1,000 years. It swept past the frozen outer planets, paused briefly above the deserts of dying Mars, and presently looked down on Earth. Spread out beneath them, the explorers saw a world swarming with life. For years they studied, collected, cataloged. When they had learned all that they could, they began to modify. They tinkered with the destinies of many species on land and in the ocean. But which of their experiments would succeed, they could not know for at least 1,000,000 years. They were patient, but they were not yet immortal. So much remained to do in this universe of 100 billion suns and other worlds were calling. So they set out once more into the abyss, knowing that they would never come this way again. Nor was there any need. The servants they had left behind would do the rest. On Earth, the glaciers came and went, while above them the changeless moon still carried its secret. With a yet slower rhythm than the polar ice, the tides of civilization ebbed and flowed across the galaxy. Strange and beautiful and terrible empires rose and fell, and passed on their knowledge to their successors. Earth was not forgotten, but another visit would serve little purpose. It was one of 1,000,000 silent worlds, few of which would ever speak.
And now, out among the stars, evolution was driving toward new goals. The first explorers of Earth had long since come to the limits of flesh and blood. As soon as their machines were better than their bodies, it was time to move. First their brains, and then their thoughts alone, they transferred into shining new homes of metal and plastic. In these, they roamed among the stars. They no longer built spaceships. They were spaceships. But the age of the machine entities swiftly passed. In their ceaseless experimenting, they had learned to store knowledge in the structure of space itself, and to preserve their thoughts for eternity in frozen lattices of light. They could become creatures of radiation, free at last from the tyranny of matter. Into pure energy, therefore, they presently transformed themselves, and on a thousand worlds the empty shells they had discarded twitched for a while in a mindless dance of death, then crumbled into rust. They were lords of the galaxy, and beyond the reach of time. They could rove at will among the stars and sink a little subtle mist through the very interstices of space. But despite their godlike powers, they had not wholly forgotten their origin in the warm slime of a vanished sea. And they still watched over the experiments their ancestors had started so long ago. Chapter 52. Ignition. He'd never expected to come there again, still less on so strange a mission. When he re-entered Discovery, the ship was far behind the fleeing Leonov and climbing ever more slowly up toward Apogove, the high point of its orbit among the outer satellites. Many a captured comet during the ages past had swung around Jupiter in just such a long ellipse, waiting for the play of rival gravities to decide its ultimate fate. All life had departed those familiar decks and corridors. The men and women who had briefly reawakened the ship had obeyed his warning. They might yet be safe, though that was still far from certain. But as the final minutes ticked away, he realized that those who controlled him could not always predict the outcome of their cosmic game. They had not yet attained the stupefying boredom of absolute omnipotence. Their experiments did not always succeed. Scattered across the universe was the evidence of many failures, some so inconspicuous that they were already lost against the cosmic background, others so spectacular that they awed and baffled the astronomers of a thousand worlds. Only minutes remained now before the outcome would be determined here. During those final minutes, he was once more alone with Hal. In that earlier existence, they could communicate only through the clumsy medium of words, tapped on a keyboard or spoken into a microphone. Now their thoughts melded together at the speed of light.
"Do you read me, Hal?"
"Yes, Dave. But where are you? I cannot see you on any of my monitors."
"That is not important.
I have new instructions for you. The infrared radiation from Jupiter on channels R23 through R35 is rising rapidly. I'm going to give you a set of limiting values. As soon as they are reached, you must point the long-range antenna toward Earth and send the following message as many times as possible."
"But that will mean breaking contact with Leonov."
"I will no longer be able to relay my Jupiter observations according to the program Dr. Chandra has given me."
"Correct, but the situation has changed.
Accept priority override, Alpha. Here are the AE-35 unit coordinates." For a fraction of a microsecond, a random memory intruded into his flow of consciousness. How strange that he should once again be concerned with the AE-35 antenna pointing unit, whose reported malfunction had led Frank Poole to his death. This time all the circuits lay open to his scrutiny, clear as the lines had once been in the palm of his hand. There could be no false alarms, nor was there any danger of them now.
"Instructions confirmed, Dave. It is good to be working with you again. Have I fulfilled my mission objectives properly?"
"Yes, Hal, you have done very well.
Now there is one final message for you to transmit to Earth, and it will be the most important one you have ever sent."
"Please let me have it, Dave."
"But why did you say final?"
Why indeed? For whole milliseconds he pondered that question, and as he did so he became aware of an emptiness he had not detected before. It had been there, but until now the barrage of new experiences and sensations had concealed it. He knew something of their plans. They had need for him. Very well, he too had needs, perhaps after a fashion, even emotions. Here was his last link with the world of men and the life he had once known.
They had granted his earlier request. It would be interesting to test the extent of their benevolence, if indeed such a term was remotely applicable to them. And it should be easy for them to do what he was asking. They had already given ample evidence of their powers when the no longer needed body of David Bowman had been casually destroyed without putting an end to David Bowman himself. They had heard him, of course. Once again there was the faint echo of an Olympian amusement, but he could detect neither acceptance or denial.
"I am still waiting for your answer, Dave."
"Correction, Hal. I should have said your last message for a long time. A very long time." He was anticipating their action, trying indeed to force their hand. But surely they would understand that his request was not unreasonable. No conscious entity could survive ages of isolation without damage, even if they would always be with him. He also needed someone, some companion, nearer to his own level of existence. The languages of mankind had many words to describe his gesture. Cheek, effrontery, chutzpah. He recalled with the perfect power of retrieval he now possessed that a French general had once declaimed, "L'audace, toujours l'audace." Perhaps it was a human characteristic that they appreciated and even shared. He would soon know. "Hal, look at the signal on infrared channels 30, 29, 28. It will be very soon now. The peak is moving toward the short wave."
"I am informing Dr. Chandra that there will be a break in my data transmission. Activating AE-35 unit. Reorienting long-range antenna. Lock confirmed on beacon Terra 1. Message commences. All these worlds..."
They had indeed left it to the last minute, or perhaps the calculations had, after all, been superbly accurate. There was time for barely 100 repetitions of the 11 words when the hammer blow of pure heat smashed into the ship. Held there by curiosity and a growing fear of the long loneliness that lay before him, that which had once been David Bowman, commander of United States Spacecraft Discovery, watched as the hull boiled stubbornly away. For a long time the ship retained its approximate shape, then the bearings of the carousel seized up, releasing instantly the stored momentum of the huge spinning flywheel. In a soundless detonation, the incandescent fragments went their myriad separate ways.
"Hello, Dave. What has happened? Where am I?"
He had not known that he could relax and enjoy a moment of successful achievement. Often before, he had felt like a pet dog controlled by a master whose motives were not wholly inscrutable and whose behavior could sometimes be modified according to his own desires. He had asked for a bone. It had been tossed to him.
"I will explain later, Hal. We have plenty of time."
They waited until the last fragments of the ship had dispersed, beyond even their powers of detection. Then they left to watch the new dawn at the place that had been prepared for them and to wait through the centuries until they were summoned once again. It is not true that astronomical events always require astronomical periods of time. The final collapse of a star before the fragments rebound in a supernova explosion can take only a second. By comparison, the metamorphosis of Jupiter was almost a leisurely affair. Even so, it was several minutes before Sasha was able to believe his eyes. He'd been making a routine telescopic examination of the planet, as if any observation could now be called routine, when it started to drift out of the field of view. For a moment, he thought that the instrument's stabilization was faulty. Then he realized, with a shock that jolted his entire concept of the universe, that Jupiter itself was moving, not the telescope. The evidence stared him in the face. He could also see two of the smaller moons, and they were quite motionless. He switched to a lower magnification so that he could see the entire disk of the planet, now a leprous mottled gray. After a few more minutes of incredulity, he saw what was really happening, but he could still scarcely believe it. Jupiter was not moving from its immemorial orbit, but it was doing something almost as impossible. It was shrinking, so swiftly that its edge was creeping across the field even as he focused upon it. At the same time, the planet was brightening from its dull gray to a pearly white. Surely it was more brilliant than it had ever been in the long years that man had observed it. The reflected light of the sun could not possibly... At that moment, Sasha suddenly realized what was happening, though not why, and sounded the general alarm. When Floyd reached the observation lounge less than 30 seconds later, his first impression was of the blinding glare pouring through the windows, painting ovals of light on the walls. They were so dazzling that he had to avert his eyes. Not even the sun could produce such brilliance. Floyd was so astonished that for a moment he did not associate the glare with Jupiter. The first thought that flashed through his mind was supernova. He dismissed that explanation almost as soon as it occurred to him. Even the sun's next-door neighbor, Alpha Centauri, could not have matched the awesome display in any conceivable explosion. The light suddenly dimmed. Sasha had operated the external sun shields. Now it was possible to look directly at the source and to see that it was a mere pinpoint, just another star showing no dimensions at all. This could have nothing to do with Jupiter. When Floyd had looked at the planet only a few minutes ago, it had been 4 times larger than the distant, shrunken sun. It was well that Sasha had lowered the shields. A moment later, that tiny star exploded, so that even through the dark filters, it was impossible to watch with the naked eye. But the final orgasm of light lasted only a brief fraction of a second, and Jupiter, or what had been Jupiter, was expanding once again. It continued to expand until it was far larger than it had been before the transformation. Soon the sphere of light was fading rapidly down to merely solar brilliance, and presently Floyd could see that it was actually a hollow shell, for the central star was still clearly visible at its heart. He did make a quick mental calculation. The ship was more than 1 light minute from Jupiter, yet that expanding shell, now turning into a bright-edged ring, already covered a quarter of the sky. That meant it was coming toward them at, my God, nearly half the speed of light. Within minutes, it would engulf the ship. Until then, no one had spoken a word since Sasha's first announcement. Some dangers are so spectacular and so much beyond normal experience that the mind refuses to accept them as real and watches the approach of doom without any sense of apprehension. The man who looks at the onrushing tidal wave, the descending avalanche, or the spinning funnel of the tornado, yet makes no attempt to flee, is not necessarily paralyzed with fright or resigned to an unavoidable fate. He may simply be unable to believe that the message of his eyes concerns him personally. It is all happening to somebody else. As might have been expected, Tanya was the first to break the spell with a series of orders that brought Vasily and Floyd hurrying to the bridge. "What do we do now?" she asked when they had assembled. "We certainly can't run away," thought Floyd, "but perhaps we can improve the odds." "The ship's broadside on," he said. "Shouldn't we turn away from that thing so we're a smaller target, and get as much of our mass as we can between it and us to act as a radiation shield?" Vasily's fingers were already flying over the controls. "You're right, Woody, though it's already too late as far as any gammas and X-rays are concerned. But there may be slower neutrons and alphas and heaven knows what else still on the way." The patterns of light began to slide down the walls as the ship turned ponderously on its axis. Presently they vanished completely. Leonov was now oriented so that virtually all its mass lay between the fragile human cargo and the approaching shell of radiation. "Will we actually feel the shock wave?" wondered Floyd, "or will the expanding gases be too tenuous to have any physical effect by the time they reach us?" Soon from the external cameras, the ring of fire now almost encircled the sky, but it was fading rapidly. Some of the brighter stars could even be seen shining through it. "We're going to live," thought Floyd. "We've witnessed the destruction of the greatest of planets, and we've survived." And presently the cameras showed nothing except stars, even if one was a billion times brighter than all the others. The bubble of fire blown by Jupiter had swept harmlessly past them, impressive though it had been. At their distance from the source, only the ship's instruments had recorded its passing. Slowly the tension aboard relaxed. As always happens in such circumstances, people started to laugh and to make silly jokes. Floyd scarcely heard them. Despite his relief at still being alive, he felt a sense of sadness. Something great and wonderful had been destroyed. Jupiter, with all its beauty and grandeur and now never-to-be-solved mysteries, had ceased to exist. The father of all the gods had been struck down in his prime. Yet there was another way of looking at the situation. They had lost Jupiter. What had they gained in its place? Tanya, judging her moment nicely, rapped for attention. "Vasily, any damage?" "Nothing serious. One camera burned out. All radiation meters still well above normal, but none near danger limits."
"Katerina, check the total dosage we've received. It looks as if we were lucky, unless there are more surprises. We certainly owe a vote of thanks to Bowman, and to you, Haywood. Do you have any idea what happened?
Only the Jupiters turned into a sun.
I always thought it was much too small for that. Didn't someone once call Jupiter the sun that failed?
That's true, said Vasily. Jupiter is too small for fusion to start, unaided.
You mean we've just seen an example of astronomical engineering?
Undoubtedly. Now we know what Zagadka was up to.
How did it do the trick? If you were given the contract, Vasily, how would you ignite Jupiter?
Vasily thought for a minute, then shrugged wryly. I'm only a theoretical astronomer. I don't have much experience in this line of business. But let's see. Well, if I'm not allowed to add about 10 Jupiter masses or change the gravitational constant, I suppose I'll have to make the planet denser. That's an idea.
His voice trailed off into silence. Everyone waited patiently, eyes flickering from time to time to the viewing screens. The star that had been Jupiter seemed to have settled down after its explosive birth. It was now a dazzling point of light, almost equal to the real sun in apparent brilliance.
I'm just thinking out loud, but it might be done this way. Jupiter was mostly hydrogen. If a large percentage could be converted into much denser material, who knows, even neutron matter, that would drop down to the core. Maybe that's what the billions of Zagadkas were doing with all the gas they were sucking in. Nucleosynthesis, building up higher elements from pure hydrogen. That would be a trick worth knowing. No more shortage of any metal. Gold as cheap as aluminum.
But how would that explain what happened?
Asked Tanya. When the core became dense enough, Jupiter would collapse, probably in a matter of seconds. The temperature would rise high enough to start fusion. Oh, I can see a dozen objections. How would they get past the iron minimum? What about radiative transfer? Chandrasekhar's limit? Never mind. This theory will do to start with. I'll work out the details later. Or I'll think of a better one.
I'm sure you will, Vasily, Floyd agreed. But there's a more important question. Why did they do it?
A warning, ventured Katerina over the ship's intercom.
Against what?
We'll find that out later.
I don't suppose, said Xenia diffidently, that it was an accident. That brought the discussion to a dead halt for several seconds.
What a terrifying idea, said Floyd. But I think we can rule it out. If that was the case, there'd have been no warning.
Perhaps. If you start a forest fire because you've been careless, at least you do your best to warn everyone.
And there's another thing we'll probably never know, lamented Vasily. I always hoped Carl Sagan would be right, and there'd be life on Jupiter.
Our probes never saw any.
What chance did they have?
Would you find any life on Earth if you looked at a few hectares of the Sahara or the Antarctic?
That's about all we ever did on Jupiter.
Hey, said Brilovsky, what about Discovery? And how?
Sasha switched on the long-range receiver and started to search on the beacon frequency. There was no trace of a signal. After a while, he announced to the silently waiting group,
Discovery's gone.
No one looked at Dr. Chandra, but there were a few muted words of sympathy, as if in consolation to a father who had just lost a son. But Hal had one last surprise for them.
Chapter 53, A Gift of Worlds. The radio message beamed to Earth moments before the blast of radiation engulfed the ship was in plain text and merely repeated over and over. All these worlds are yours, except Europa. Attempt no landings there. There were 93 repetitions, then the letters became garbled and the transmission abruptly ceased between accept and Europa. I begin to understand, said Floyd, when the message had been relayed by an awed and anxious mission control. That's quite a parting present, a new sun and the planets around it.
But why only three? Asked Tanya.
Let's not be greedy, Floyd replied. I can think of one very good reason. We know there's life on Europa. Bowman, or his friends, whoever they may be, want us to leave it alone.
That makes good sense in another way, said Vasily. I've been doing some calculations.
Assuming that Sol 2 has settled down and will continue to radiate at its present level, Europa should have a nice tropical climate when the ice has melted, which it's doing pretty quickly right now. What about the other moons? Ganymede will be quite pleasant. The Dayside will be temperate. Callisto will be very cold, though if there's much outgassing, the new atmosphere may make it habitable. But Io will be even worse than it is now, I expect. No great loss. It was hell even before this happened. Don't write off Io, said Curnow. I know a lot of Tex-Arab oilmen who'd love to tackle it just on general principles. There must be something valuable in a place as nasty as that. And by the way, I've just had a rather disturbing thought. Anything that disturbs you must be serious, said Vasily. What is it? Why did Hal send that message to Earth and not to us? We were much closer. There was a rather long silence, and Floyd said thoughtfully, I see what you mean. Perhaps he wanted to make certain it was received on Earth.
But he knew we would relay it.
Oh! Tanya's eyes widened, as if she had just become aware of something unpleasant. You've lost me, complained Vasily. I think this is what Walter's driving at, said Floyd. It's all very well to feel grateful to Bowman, or whatever gave that warning, but that's all they did. We could still have been killed.
But we weren't, answered Tanya. We saved ourselves, by our own efforts. And perhaps that was the whole idea. If we hadn't, we wouldn't have been worth saving. You know, survival of the fittest, Darwinian selection, eliminating the genes for stupidity.
I have an unpleasant feeling you're right, said Curnow. And if we'd stuck to our launch date and not used Discovery as a booster, would it or they have done anything to save us? That wouldn't have required much extra effort for an intelligence that could blow up Jupiter. There was an uneasy silence, broken at last by Heywood Floyd. On the whole, he said, I'm very glad that's one question we'll never get answered. Chapter 54, Between Suns. The Russians, thought Floyd, are going to miss Walter's songs and wisecracks on the way home. After the excitement of the last few days, the long fall sunward and earthward will seem a monotonous anticlimax, but a monotonous, uneventful trip was what everyone devoutly hoped for. He was already feeling sleepy, but was still aware of his surroundings and capable of reacting to them. Will I look as dead when I'm in hibernation? He asked himself. It was always disconcerting to look at another person, especially someone very familiar, when he had entered the long sleep. Perhaps it was too poignant a reminder of one's own mortality. Curnow was completely out, but Chandra was still awake, though already groggy from the final injection. He was obviously no longer himself, for he seemed quite unperturbed by his own nakedness or Katerina's watchful presence. The gold lingam that was his only article of clothing kept trying to float away from him until its chain recaptured it.
"Everything going okay, Katerina?" asked Floyd.
"Perfectly. But how I envy you. In 20 minutes you'll be home."
"If that's any consolation, how can you be sure we won't have some horrible dreams?"
"No one's ever reported any."
"Ah, they may forget them when they wake up."
Katerina, as usual, took him quite seriously. "Impossible. If there were dreams in hibernation, the EEC records would have revealed them."
"Okay, Chandra, close your eyes." "There he goes.
Now it's your turn, Heywood. The ship will seem very strange without you."
"Thanks, Katerina. Hope you have a nice trip."
Drowsy though he was, Floyd became aware that Surgeon Commander Rudenko seemed a little uncertain. Even, could it be, shy. It looked as if she wanted to tell him something, but couldn't make up her mind.
"What is it, Katerina?" he said sleepily.
"I haven't told anyone else yet, but you certainly won't be talking. Here's a little surprise."
"You'd better hurry."
"Max and Xenia are going to get married."
"That is supposed to be a surprise?"
"No, it's just to prepare you. When we get back to Earth, so are Walter and I.
What do you think of that?" "Now I understand why you were spending so much time together. Yes, it is indeed a surprise. Who would have thought it?" "I'm very happy to
here.
Floyd's voice faded out before he could complete the sentence, but he was not yet unconscious and was still able to focus some of his dissolving intellect on this new situation. I really don't believe it, he said to himself. Walter will probably change his mind before he wakes up. And then he had one final thought just before he went to sleep himself. If Walter does change his mind, he'd better not wake up. Dr. Heywood Floyd thought that was very funny. The rest of the crew often wondered why he was smiling all the way back to Earth. Chapter 55, Lucifer Rising. 50 times more brilliant than the full moon, Lucifer had transformed the skies of Earth, virtually banishing night for months at a time. Despite its sinister connotations, the name was inevitable, and indeed Lightbringer had brought evil as well as good. Only the centuries and the millennia would show in which direction the balance tilted. On the credit side, the end of night had vastly extended the scope of human activity, especially in the less developed countries. Everywhere, the need for artificial lighting had been substantially reduced, with resulting huge savings in electrical power. It was as if a giant lamp had been hoisted into space to shine upon half the globe. Even in daytime, Lucifer was a dazzling object, casting distinct shadows. Farmers, mayors, city managers, police, seamen, and almost all those engaged in outdoor activities, especially in remote areas, welcomed Lucifer. It had made their lives much safer and easier, but it was hated by lovers, criminals, naturalists, and astronomers. The first two groups found their activities seriously restricted, while naturalists were concerned about Lucifer's impact upon animal life. Many nocturnal creatures had been seriously affected, while others had managed to adapt. The Pacific grunion, whose celebrated mating pattern was locked to high tides and moonless nights, was in grave trouble and seemed to be heading for rapid extinction. And so, it seemed, were Earth-based astronomers. That was not such a scientific catastrophe as it would once have been, for more than 50% of astronomical research depended upon instruments in space or on the moon. They could be easily shielded from Lucifer's glare. But terrestrial observatories were seriously inconvenienced by the new sun in what had once been the night sky. The human race would adapt, as it had done to so many changes in the past. A generation would soon be born that had never known a world without Lucifer, but that brightest of all stars would be an eternal question to every thinking man and woman. Why had Jupiter been sacrificed? And how long would the new sun radiate? Would it burn out quickly, or would it maintain its power for thousands of years, perhaps for the lifetime of the human race? Above all, why the interdiction upon Europa, a world now as cloud-covered as Venus? There must be answers to those questions, and mankind would never be satisfied until it had found them. Epilogue, 20,001. And because in all the galaxy they had found nothing more precious than mind, they encouraged its dawning everywhere. They became farmers in the fields of stars. They sowed, and sometimes they reaped. And sometimes, dispassionately, they had to weed. Only during the last few generations have the Europans ventured into the far side, beyond the light and warmth of their never-setting sun, into the wilderness where the ice that once covered all their world may still be found. And even fewer have remained there to face the brief and fearful night that comes when the brilliant but powerless cold sun sinks below the horizon. Yet already those few hardy explorers have discovered that the universe around them is stranger than they ever imagined. The sensitive eyes they developed in the dim oceans still serve them well. They can see the stars and the other bodies moving in their sky. They have begun to lay the foundations of astronomy, and some daring thinkers have even surmised that the great world of Europa is not the whole of creation. Very soon after they had emerged from the ocean, during the explosively swift evolution forced upon them by the melting of the ice, they had realized that the objects in the sky fell into three distinct classes. Most important, of course, was the sun. Some legends, though few took them seriously, claimed that it had not always been there, but had appeared suddenly, heralding a brief cataclysmic age of transformation, when much of Europa's teeming life had been destroyed. If that was indeed true, it was a small price to pay for the benefits that poured down from the tiny, inexhaustible source of energy that hung unmoving in the sky. Perhaps the cold sun was its distant brother, banished for some crime and condemned to march forever around the vault of heaven. It was of no importance except to those peculiar Europans who were always asking questions about matters that all sensible folk took for granted. Still, it must be admitted that those cranks had made some interesting discoveries during their excursions into the darkness of Farside. They claimed, though this was hard to believe, that the whole sky was sprinkled with uncountable myriads of tiny lights, even smaller and feebler than the cold sun. They varied greatly in brilliance, and though they rose and set, they never moved from their fixed positions. Against this background, there were three objects that did move, apparently obeying complex laws that no one had yet been able to fathom. And unlike all the others in the sky, they were quite large, though both shape and size varied continually. Sometimes they were disks, sometimes half circles, sometimes slim crescents. They were obviously closer than all the other bodies in the universe, for their surfaces showed an immense wealth of complex and ever-changing detail. The theory that they were indeed other worlds had at last been accepted, though no one except a few fanatics believed that they could be anything like as large or as important as Europa. One lay toward the sun and was in a constant state of turmoil. On its night side could be seen the glow of great fires, a phenomenon still beyond the understanding of the Europans, for their atmosphere, as yet, contains no oxygen. And sometimes vast explosions hurl clouds of debris up from the surface. If the sunward globe is indeed a world, it must be a very unpleasant place to live, perhaps even worse than the night side of Europa. The two outer and more distant spheres seem to be much less violent places, yet in some ways they are even more mysterious. When darkness falls upon their surfaces, they too show patches of light, but these are very different from the swiftly changing fires of the turbulent inner world. They burn with an almost steady brilliance and are concentrated in a few small areas, though over the generations these areas have grown and multiplied. But strangest of all are the lights, fierce as tiny suns that can often be observed moving across the darkness between these other worlds. Once, recalling the bioluminescence of their own seas, some Europans had speculated that these might indeed be living creatures. But their intensity makes that almost incredible. Nevertheless, more and more thinkers believe that these lights, the fixed patterns, and the moving suns must be some strange manifestation of life. Against this, however, there is one very potent argument. If they are living things, why do they never come to Europa? Yet there are legends. Thousands of generations ago, soon after the conquest of the land, it is said that some of those lights came very close indeed, but they always exploded in sky-filling blasts that far outshone the sun, and strange hard metals rained down upon the land. Some of them are still worshipped to this day. None is as holy, though, as the huge black monolith that stands in the frontier of eternal day, one side forever turned to the unmoving sun, the other facing into the land of night. 10 times the height of the tallest Europan, even when he raises his tendrils to the fullest extent, it is the very symbol of mystery and unattainability, for it has never been touched. It can only be worshipped from afar. Around it lies the circle of power, which repels all who try to approach. It is that same power, many believe, that keeps at bay those moving lights in the sky. If it ever fails, they will descend upon the virgin continents and shrinking seas of Europa, and their purpose will be revealed at last. The Europans would be surprised to know with what intensity and baffled wonder that black monolith is also studied by the minds behind those moving lights. For centuries now, their automatic probe has made a cautious descent from orbit, always with the same disastrous result. For until the time is ripe, the monolith will permit no contact. When that time comes, when perhaps the Europans have invented radio and discovered the messages continually bombarding them from so close at hand, the monolith may change its strategy. It may, or it may not, choose to release the entities who slumber within it, so that they can bridge the gulf between the Europans and the race to which they once held allegiance.
and it may be that no such bridge is possible, and that two such alien forms of consciousness can never coexist. If this is so, then only one of them can inherit the solar system. Which it will be, not even the gods know. Yet. Acknowledgements. My first thanks, of course, must go to Stanley Kubrick, who a rather long time ago wrote to ask if I had any ideas for the proverbial good science fiction movie. Next, my appreciation to my friend and agent, the two are not always synonymous, Scott Meredith, for perceiving that a 10-page movie outline I sent him as an intellectual exercise had rather wider possibilities, and that I owed it to posterity, etc., etc. Other thanks are due to Señor Jorge Luis Calife of Rio de Janeiro for a letter which started me thinking seriously about a possible sequel after I'd said for years that one was clearly impossible. Dr. Bruce Murray, past director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Pasadena, and Dr. Frank Jordan, also of JPL, for computing the Lagrange 1 position in the Io Jupiter system. Oddly enough, I had made identical calculations 34 years earlier for the collinear Earth-Moon Lagrange points. Stationary Orbits, Journal of the British Astronomical Association, December 1947. But I no longer trust my ability to solve quintic equations, even with the help of Hal Jr., my trusty H/P9100A. New American Library, copyright owners of 2001, A Space Odyssey, for permission to use the material in Chapter 51, Chapter 37 of 2001, A Space Odyssey, and also quotations in Chapters 30 and 40. General Potter, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, for finding time in his busy schedule to show me around Epcot in 1969, when it was only a few large holes in the ground. Wendell Solomons, for help with Russian and Rush-Lish. Jean-Michel Jarre, Vangelis, and the incomparable John Williams for inspiration whenever it was needed, C.P. Cavafy for Waiting for the Barbarians. While writing this book, I discovered that the concept of refueling on Europa had been discussed in a paper, Outer Planet Satellite Return Missions Using In Situ Propellant Production, by Ash, Stancati, Niehoff, and Kuda. Acta Astronautica 8, 5 and 6, May to June 1981. The idea of automatically exponentiating systems, von Neumann machines, for extraterrestrial mining has been seriously developed by von Tiesenhausen and Darbo of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. See Self-Replicating Systems, NASA Technical Memorandum 78304. If anyone doubts the power of such systems to cope with Jupiter, I refer them to the study showing how self-replicating factories could cut production time for a solar power collector from 60,000 years to a mere 20. The startling idea that gas giants might have diamond cores has been seriously put forward by M. Ross and F. Ree of the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, University of California, for the cases of Uranus and Neptune. It seems to me that anything they can do, Jupiter could do better. De Beers shareholders, please note. For more details on the aerial life forms that might exist in the Jovian atmosphere, see my story, A Meeting with Medusa, in The Wind from the Sun. Such creatures have been beautifully depicted by Adolf Schaller in Part 2 of Carl Sagan's Cosmos, One Voice in the Cosmic Fugue, both book and TV series. The fascinating idea that there might be life on Europa beneath ice-covered oceans kept liquid by the same Jovian tidal forces that heat Io was first proposed by Richard C. Hoagland in the magazine Star and Sky, The Europa Enigma, January 1980. This quite brilliant concept has been taken seriously by a number of astronomers, notably NASA's Institute of Space Studies, Dr. Robert Jastrow, and may provide one of the best motives for the projected Galileo mission. And finally, Valerie and Hector for providing the life support system, Shireen for punctuating every chapter with sticky kisses, Steve for being here. Colombo, Sri Lanka, July 1981 to March 1982.
This book was written on an Archives 3 microcomputer with WordStar software and sent from Colombo to New York on 1 5-inch diskette. Last-minute corrections were transmitted through the Paducah Earth Station and the Indian Ocean Intelsat 5. End of 2010 Odyssey 2 by Arthur C. Clarke.